Welcome to the Marvel Us podcast, our first episode ever. I'm Tom Laurie. I'm joined by my sister,
Leona Laurie.
And today we'll be discussing the 1998 motion picture Blade, starring Wesley Snipes, considered Marvel's first box office success. Would you like to know a little bit about Blade as a historical character before this movie?
Yeah, I would like to know that very much.
Well, there isn't a lot. he was created by Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan in 1973 as a side character in Marvel's, offshoot about hunting vampires. But,
so would that make him about the same age as Luke Cage as far as characters
yes,
go?
Yes, and like Luke Cage, he was written like a stereotypical black guy in the 70s, and Marv Wolfman did not feel comfortable with that, so he put him on ice, and he pretty much stayed there until the early 90s, where he was revived partially in this effort to get this movie made. I think they started working on the movie in, 1993 or something, and originally wanted LL Cool J to play Blade.
Okay.
And it was going to be sort of a comedic take. Seems like the descriptions of what it originally was going to be like are pretty vague, but the hack screenwriter, David S. Goyer, who wound up writing it, said that Sony and Marvel originally wanted it to be... Was it Sony? I don't know. Yeah, I think so. Anyway, they wanted it to be like a parody, sounded kind of like Evil Dead kind of thing, which is a little coincidental since Sam Raimi wound up doing all their Spider-Man movies, but the writer convinced them, no, this needs to be very serious, and that's how we got what we got.
Are you ready for me to interject now?
Sure, should we start going over what the movie was and what happened?
Is that the end of the history?
I mean, yeah, other than Marvel's other attempts at movies prior, which were pretty much just
the Fantastic Four over and over.
No, this is the beginning.
I forget that it's just an Arrested Development plotline.
The Arrested Development plotline, I think, is partially based on the Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie that never came out, but was just made to hold on to the rights of the Fantastic Four, and is allegedly better than the actual Fantastic Four movies that did come out. But similarly, there was a Captain America movie in the early 90s that was really shitty and never got a theatrical release in America and went straight to video. But the two theatrical movies Marvel did get out were The Punisher, starring Dolph Lundgren, and Howard the Duck.
Well, it's interesting you say that LL Cool J was supposed to be the lead originally, because while we were watching it, I was thinking, who was working in Hollywood at this time who could have been better than Wesley Snipes in this role? And I couldn't come up with anybody I thought would be better in that role. Like, better in a role? Like, could they have made the role better? But I guess LL Cool J is as good as anybody else to be in also-ran.
I mean, I like Wesley Snipes in the role. Theoretically, I think it's interesting that it started as a spoof, because I think, there are so many weird moments in the movie where it's it feels like Wesley Snipes wants to be funny or do something funny or has a funny line that are so at odds with every other second in the movie. If they had leaned in, what we think of now as Marvel movie tone, like cracking wise and riffing and whatnot, I think it would have been a lot stronger. I can't remember the second movie enough to know if they went in that direction, but this guy, David S. Goyer, did write the next two, so I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, I think, if you were describing the current ones, let's say Guardians of the Galaxy 2, the most recent one to come out as of the day that we're recording this, they're so fleet-footed. They move so lightly through the content that you just have this sense of immersion. Oh, I'm so in the moment right now that I'm going to have to rewatch this movie. And in this one, it was so plodding, so heavy in its pacing. And while we were watching it, I was like, it's not that it's literally moving slowly right now. It just feels like it's moving so slowly.
I think the case for most of the Goyer movies I've seen is most of the dialogue is exposition. There's very little characterization to any of it, except for, like, the couple of wisecracks that Blade gets in here and there, which are at odds with the rest of the movie. But, I mean, I guess at that point, should we get into what actually happens in the movie? What the movie is?
You're the boss, boss.
Okay, so I think it was in the late 60s, a pregnant woman is bitten by a vampire.
Early 60s, 64.
Has a baby and dies. And the 69? Baby...
69? Maybe you're right. Sorry. I think it's 64.
Let's it's, get no, it's hung gotta up be, on It's got to be like 67 or 68, because it's 30 years later and it's the late 90s.
At some point in the 60s, a lady is bitten point, by a vampire 30 years-ish
prior.
Okay.
A pregnant woman is bit by a vampire and gives birth to a half-vampire baby. And that baby is Blade. At some point, he is raised by Kris Kristofferson.
He finds him feeding off the homeless when he's about 14.
They make a bunch of weapons out of silver and get a bunch of guns and live in a factory together, which I learned was a shampoo factory in real life. And the story starts with, like, some douchey Hollywood type, which is, this is one of the most confusing parts of the movie. It seemed like we live in Southern California, you lived in LA for a while. So
I lived in Hollywood for a while.
It's very much L.A. It's very obvious L.A. in, like, every shot, exterior shot. And we're like, oh, this is set in L.A. But there are so many things about it. They're like, would any of this ancient vampire culture stuff be taking place in L.A.? Like, L.A. is such a young city. It seems so weird for any of this to be set in L.A. In my research, apparently there's a scene where, like, while Blade's father figure, Whistler, is talking to his love interest, Karen, and in the background, Blade is looking at a map of New Orleans, which I think suggests that it is set in New Orleans, but also in the comics, I think he's from Detroit, and his mother's, her ID card, I don't know if it was a driver's license or what, but you see that for a moment, and it says she's from Florida. So at the very least, the movie starts in Florida, and then happens somewhere else. Who knows where? That it's in America at all is you know, weird enough. But, like,
European people, because all the bad guy vampires are white and of European looking descent.
Or vaguely movie. Asian.
Well, yeah, okay, but they're not Native American.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
And they are not.
There is a black guy.
They're not.
Either way, it's a very multicultural, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, there's nothing to suggest that people with ancestors are. Who would be reasonably in the United States, in any part of the United States, let alone California, are in this movie as vampires.
Which, I mean, fine, you know, like, there is so much...
You can say that you have, like, a great-great-great-grandfather, but we don't say ancestors. We haven't been here long enough.
But, like, and even then, it's like, everyone, you know, America, oh, country of immigrants, whatever, everyone comes here, so...
Come here with your ancient vampire temple.
It's yeah, that's the, like, that's the thing.
It's kind of like a missile silo.
We'll get there, like...
It's mostly but, like,
there's more than just the people that are rooted in America and this, where it's, like, the whole vampire culture has roots here somehow. Anyway. This douchey LA type gets dragged to a underground club through a meat locker, and there's a DJ spinning... And I think is it Tracy Lords who takes him there?
Yes.
And then blood starts coming out of the fire sprinklers. And
because
the
name,
like,
of the club is Bloodbath. That's their gimmick, is for there to be fire sprinklers of blood coming down on you. So it's interesting, though, because it's not called the Bronze.
Well, yeah, I mean, the vampires didn't really hang out at the Bronze.
No, they kind of took it over intermittently. And in the alternate universe that Cordelia created... By wishing that Buffy never came, the Bronze was all vampires. What I'm saying is, this is happening concurrent to Buffy's vampire scene at the Bronze, and when you get to the point I'm thinking that you're on your way to in a minute about vampire club wear dress code, it very, until the blood starts coming out of the fire sprinklers, it very much was like, you know what, let's make it as much like the Bronze as we can, but with some differentiators that make it more adult. Like, you have to enter through a slaughter... house facility, and instead of a 90s relevant band, DJ, electronic club music.
And everyone's either wearing black leather or all white, and all the women are in their bras.
The ladies
which at first
walk
is like,
in.
Man, this is some weird fashion, until the blood starts coming down. You're like, oh, they were here to get bled all over.
Well, I think you were correct to point out, though, when we were watching it, that also brassiere was fashion for club wear at that point in the 1990s, where it's like, you know, you wear your sheer, satiny blouse over your mesh matching
top.
Bra, and that's club apparel. There you go.
They're all teaming up on this this douchey guy. Record scratch, Blade steps in.
What?
And just starts fucking killing people.
Dude. Everybody's like, there's 150 to 500 of us, and one dude has come in. Run!
Blade is one of the few people who thinks, I should have a gun. I should have probably lots of guns, and most of the vampires do not think of this, and instead just run at him or grab meat hooks, and he kills them all, except for Donald Logue, who he shoots his silver stakes.
Yeah, his silver stakes.
He has a shotgun that on the bottom has two silver stakes that it can also launch, and he sort of crucifies him to this wall and then sets him ablaze, and this will be a fun thing to note. You noted that, oh, where's the Stan Lee cameo? This would have been the first Stan Lee cameo. He was one of the cops who came in to collect the torched Donald Logue, but they cut that scene, so
okay.
It was delayed until I don't know, Spider-Man, or maybe, I can't remember. So
he cuts off part of his arm in that scene, doesn't he, too? Because he's cutting off Donald Logue's arms every time he sees him.
Yeah, I can't remember when the first arm chop happens.
It's their thing.
It's definitely the runner of this film, Donald Logue losing arms. Blade's motivations are questionable throughout the movie, but this is definitely the first sign of that, where he doesn't kill Donald Logue, even though he kills all these other vampires, and he definitely knows, I mean, after this huge shootout brawl, he definitely has to know the cops are coming, so leaving a still alive Donald Logue pinned to this wall, he has to figure there's going to be some aftermath from that, and he does end up following the corpse, seeming corpse, to the hospital, where we are introduced to
Dr. Karen,
who is doing the autopsy with some douchey guy she dated in the past and who's trying to reignite that flame.
He's like, let me make the Y incision into this charred corpse I've invited you to come take a look at. Do you ever have second thoughts about us?
It's a really hot moment. I'm surprised more didn't come of it. Because Donald Logue wakes up and bites the dude on the neck.
Yeah, but she's, like, got her hands in his mouth through this whole bizarro courtship number, and they resisted the temptation to have Donald Logue just bite her fingers while she's in there. I would have liked that. That would have set a different tone for the film that I would have been receptive to.
It really would have changed the direction had Donald Logue bitten someone's fingers.
Yes.
Also, really would have played into the whole chopping off arms stuff. Like, that doesn't come back for a while after this. Because Blade shows up, starts trying to kill, like, in most movies, someone shooting up a hospital would be like, oh, this is a big deal. Like,
yeah, but
there would be some fallout.
It's like pre-Columbine, pre-9/11.
Yeah,
Shooting up a hospital was not as big a deal in 1998 as it is today.
I guess. People didn't know that, like, oh man, these guns have so many bullets. What if someone, like, used all of them? That would be some serious shit. Instead, they were just like, wait a second. Except for something I did kind of appreciate. I don't know. I mean, it's hard not to think of it this way, but it's also hard to imagine anyone involved with this movie thought of it this way. But how the cops, although later they explain that the cops are owned by the vampire, so it's very probable that they all know who Blade is already. But how the cops see Blade and immediately start shooting to kill, all these cops being scared of the big black guy trying to kill him immediately without even really assessing what's going on, especially when there is a charred vampire running around in the same scene. Charred vampire gets away, Blade grabs Karen, she also got bit, right?
She's been all bitten up, and so she's like on the floor being like, and then he says with his face, you look like my mom. And then flashback to mom's driver's license that he carries around. And so he's like, I have a soft spot for you. So he throws her out a window across the street, where she lands on some conveniently placed bales of whatever on the rooftop.
Roof boxes. And then boxes. He
jumps after her, and gunshots ensue.
And then they escape through the building. He takes her to his shampoo factory, where she meets Whistler, and they inject her with a, what is it, like?
Garlic.
Distilled garlic.
It's like
some sort of
essence of garlic, period.
Essence of garlic, and that's supposed to prevent her from being infected with the vampire virus and keep her human, and they're all like, oh,
if we caught early enough.
Yeah, you know, there's lots of wondering if she's going to turn and, you know, telling her to kill herself if she does, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, but they never say why. Like, the whole vampire lifestyle doesn't seem all that bad.
Mm.
And the vampires seem to have a lot of free will.
Yeah, the vampires...
So, like, the whole kill yourself if you're a vampire, is it just because you would have to live on human blood? And is that true? Because they went to the bloodbath, and they weren't really drinking the blood from the ceiling, but they never address in the movie whether or not they're able to live on non-human blood, and that is a very common vampire trope in other media.
Also, something we watch with regularity is iZombie. And she's a doctor, so, I mean, if you're ever looking for an easy way to get your hand on some blood without killing anyone...
They even have that plot point in this, that right, the vampires own blood banks in every city.
That would at least require her to, you know, get into vampire society and have, you know, some connection to these crooked cops and crooked politicians who are owned or are vampires. Whereas, you know, if she's a doctor, like...
Right, but I'm just saying...
Like,
they,
as far as situations go, she could make it work.
They never set us up for any reason why it's bad to be a vampire, except for...
They do set up lots of reasons why it's super easy to be a vampire, though.
Yeah, like, you're super strong, you heal really fast, etc., etc., but the only thing they ever say through the whole movie about why being a vampire is bad is that Blade feels guilty about drinking homeless people when he was a kid. So...
And they killed his mom. Or did they?
So, while she's recovering, he takes off, and she has her moment where she wanders around the room in their shampoo factory, noticing all the tchotchkes and Zen meditation corner, and then walks in on them having the serum for the first time. While she's recovering,
right.
He goes off to the
Chinese doctor. Yeah, one of the many scenes of someone getting injected with something and then writhing around a lot.
Yeah. So, Kris Kristofferson shoots Wesley Snipes full of mystery serum, which she witnesses, and then they're very gruff with her.
She tries to escape, and they're like, hey, you can't escape because you still might turn into a vampire, but also, now that you've been bit, every vampire ever is still going to try to kill you, so, I mean, good luck, I guess.
Yeah, that didn't make any sense to me either.
They're very reluctant to let her go, but also completely unwilling to help her in any way or seek her help, even though Whistler's like, hey, she's like some sort of blood doctor. She could probably make some blood serum to stop you from wanting to drink blood all the time. And Blade's like, no, thank you.
Well, also, that whole exchange where they're like, you need to leave town because the vampires are going to be after you. I was like, why are they going to be after her? If she's going to turn into a vampire...
She's marked. They know about her now, because she got bit once.
Yeah, but, like, if she becomes a vampire, isn't she just automatically on their team?
I don't know.
I don't know.
She'd probably be pretty low on the pecking order, and since she's a doctor, they'd probably want her to get blood for them. It's, I don't know. It's unclear, and also uninteresting. Blade tries to ditch her, but she's like, no, I'm sticking with you.
Lord. She's like, listen, you've been really awful to me this whole time, aside from technically saving my life. I'll stick with you.
Well, I mean, she is correct in that if anyone's going to kill the vampires that try to get to her, it'll be this guy whose literal only concern seems to be killing vampires. When does he meet Deacon Frost, the main antagonist of the series, the movie?
Oh, Vaperig, McVapyrig. He's still on real cigarettes, but now he is the spokesman for some blue vape rig that I see on TV, and I'm like, oh man, what's up with you?
The heck's his name, though?
I'm finding out. It's not Skeet Ulrich. That's
no.
What I keep wanting to say. you know, Skeet Ulrich.
It's also a dumb name, but the dumb name is
Steven
the second.
Steven Dorff.
Dorff, that's right. Man, what if his name was Skeet Dorff? That'd be pretty great.
Anyway, what do you want to know about his first meeting with Skeet Dorff?
Because when does that happen?
It takes a while. First, he has to cut off Donald Logue's other arm, I think. Because Donald Logue has zero new arms at a certain point. They have that whole subway chase scene.
But oh, is that no? Is that when they go to see
Skeet
the
Ulrich person?
Is that when they go to see the giant fat vampire?
Yeah, they go to the archives where they keep a giant.
But before that,
blob
okay, before that, we see that's right. So the crooked cop. Karen tries to go home, and there's a cop in her apartment. And he's obviously shady as hell, and he's like, oh, no, I'm a friendly cop. Psych, I'm going to kill you.
Just doing a regular check. Standard check. Has a cop ever come into your home and been like, I'm inside your house without knocking? Just doing a regular check.
She tries to mace him with her vampire mace.
And he's like, why are you spraying garlic in my face? That's so weird.
Well, then, you know, Blade shows up to save the day, which in Blade terms means break everything you own.
Break. You know what it reminds me of? Ah, I was trying to place this while we were watching it. You know the episode of Making History where
they're trying to find the tiny musicians?
They leave the founding fathers alone in the apartment and they're trying to find the musicians in the stereo and they're just like breaking everything in the apartment. That is what every scene with Blade indoors was like in this movie.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So he beats the hell out of this crooked cop and then informs Karen that, oh, this guy is a vampire thrall. He's some hanger-on lackey who's just waiting for his chance to become a vampire. Even though Blade knew of the existence of these guys, he did not think to tell Karen about this or to arm her with anything more substantive than
she's
garlic
bait.
Spray.
He did
yeah,
it on
true.
Purpose. He wants to follow that
guy. He keeps
that
using
guy.
Her as bait. That's pretty much the entire movie, is her repeatedly being bait, either doing that intentionally so that he can get to some vampires or having it done against his will so that some vampires can get to him.
Mm-hmm.
So he beats the hell out of the cop. I can't remember how he finds out. Is this how he finds out about where to go check out the... he takes the crooked cop and is like, show me the entrance. Show me the entrance and... is pushing him through like a kitchen at like some other club.
It's like a creepy,
right? Like a creepy
Japanese businessman vampire club where they watch Japanese schoolgirl performers who are supposed to be singing but are waving the microphones around with such little regard for them that you know for sure they're not.
So they go through this club and he's like, "Oh, it's in the freezer." So he opens the freezer and it's not a freezer; it's a secret passage down into this
vampire history archive.
It's like a server farm, right? And they're like, "Oh, what's that smell?" I think it's while they're going through here that we see what Deacon is doing, where he's on his computer tightening up the graphics on level 3 because in his many years as a vampire, he took a lot of CAD and computer programming courses. And use them to construct a 3D rendering
music video.
Yes, a scene from Lawnmower Man that will turn him into the or not. I don't, it seems like at this point he thinks this ancient device will like resurrect or summon some sort of vampire god, but
the blood god.
Yes, La Magra, I think, is what they call it.
Dire Straits. Why did I say Men at Work? Dire Straits music video.
Yes, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
You
know those Men at Work videos, and everybody's like, no, no. Money for nothing. That's what I meant.
So he's clanking away on his power book, and Blade is going through the server farm with Karen. They're like, oh, what's that stinking smell? And they discover it's a huge, giant, fat vampire who's like the vampire IT guy. Who is nude and fat and huge. It's like...
It's so weird!
Everything about this character is baffling in that it's like every other... Like there are pretty much two vampire archetypes otherwise where it's like, oh, you're either a young hot person or you're an old wizened person. And then there's just this...
Flesh pile.
Enormously fat, but also with like a modulated super high voice. Like,
it looks like somebody involved in the production was a Terry Gilliam fan. It was like, what kind of grotesque would Terry Gilliam put in this archive basement?
We got to get some weird body horror going on here.
Yeah.
Ugh. And so this...
What does it remind me of? Is it a Terry Gilliam thing where there's like this big, loafy person? Oh, maybe it's, you know who it is? It's Bill Paxton's character in Weird Science after she turns him into that toad creature. And he's like farting and there's like pus bubbling out of him. That is what that thing reminded me of. I've never seen
Weird Science.
I feel like that's a fail on my part.
While they're asking the
flesh pile
large creature about what this whole archive server farm, what the whole deal is here, he's like, oh, you know, it's nothing. So they start torturing him with a UV flashlight, which, like, that's like a thing, right? Like UV bulbs, like they treat it like it's this, you know, this high tech device of this huge like car battery hanging off of it. And when Karen uses it, she shakes like she's using a proton pack or something.
She really did.
It's a very, very odd thing. Anyway, it burns up the giant vampire, and eventually he gives up that, oh, they're, you know, making...
She is so blasé about it. He's like, Blade is like...
She's into it.
Shoot this guy with this flashlight if he moves. And then he moves barely, and she just toasts him. And Blade's like, what the hell? And she's like... He moved.
He's like, cool.
And you're like, oh, she's really warmed up to this whole killing thing very quickly. I guess she doesn't kill him right then. They blow him up later. Sorry, 20-year-old spoiler. They blow him up. We're getting to that in a second.
They blow him up?
Yeah, they blow up the whole archives.
Oh, I suppose, because that's something we'll get to eventually. I like, when you say they blew him up, at this point, I assume that means an exploding vampire. We're not talking about time
cop yet. Okay,
because that's a huge element of this movie, is how vampires... fucking explode. So,
all right.
While they're interrogating this guy, Blade's putting his plastic explosives all over this this door, and he's like, "What's behind this door?" And for some reason, this burnt up giant vampire is still like, "Oh, it's nothing. I can definitely lie my way out of this one, even though I cannot physically stand." So apparently, weird. And
but let's not move away from the plastic explosive too quickly, because that was one of my favorite things in the movie. There was, like, one chase scene that I liked the way it was shot, and then the way that his plastic explosive worked, it was, like, the most beautiful cheese whiz you've ever seen, where it went on so delicately in such a consistent pattern all the way around the door.
Yeah, it's a cool
foam. But then it was an explosive.
So Karen burns up the guy, and in the background on the guy's computers, you can see Deacon's 3D rendering.
Money for nothing video.
Of, yeah, and so you know... That's related to whatever this is. They blow open the door and go in, and framed in huge panels of glass are all these ancient scrolls, which are the pages of the Book of Erebus. And I don't know how it's quite a book, because, man, that would be one hell of a huge book that's, like, as tall as a person and who knows how many pages long. Either way. It's the Vampire Bible, which is a kind of a recurring thing in vampire lore, is that they have their own Bible. More vampires come to fight Blade, and to beat them, he breaks everything. He destroys...
Nobody cares!
Every single page of this ancient Vampire Bible that's sealed in these...
decorative glass panels.
Yeah, these glass panes in this secret vault hidden under this building. They just fucking destroy the whole thing. He fights a little girl who is also a vampire. Then they beat a hasty escape. Oh, wait, is that when he cuts off Donald Logue's hand again?
Okay, yes. He does cut off Donald Logue's hand. They
escape. Yeah, because Donald Logue's like, oh, check it out. My hand grew back, jerk.
It's so stupid.
And they cut his
hand. They blow everything up and they go in the subway.
They escape through
tunnel.
The subway tunnels.
Blah, blah,
and
blah.
Whistler, like, disappears and Blade's like, don't worry, he can handle himself. And then you, like, very briefly see Whistler crawling into, like, a sewer, like a manhole cover or something.
Yeah, just like a Ninja Turtle.
Like, that's probably the most eerie. Like, I mean, the writing isn't great, and the story is stupid, but I like the aesthetic. I'm like, almost embarrassingly into the whole, like, vampire nightclub scene aesthetic. Like, That's something I couldn't find any evidence of, but have always been curious about. There's this role-playing game called Vampire the Masquerade, which is aesthetically very similar to the stuff in Blade, where, you know, it's just like people with slick back hair and leather jackets who are vampires in nightclubs in the 90s, more or less. And I'm not sure which defined that aesthetic first, because they both emerge in the early 90s around the same time, so it's unclear who's ripping off who, or if it's just a coincidence or what. But I like that idea, and I wish it had sucked less, because, like, the action is the disappointing part. That's something we were talking about a bit, is how, timeline-wise, this is a year before The Matrix, and so many of the aesthetics are so similar, where it's like all that, like,
black leather pseudo-goth
nightclub scene stuff and late 90s industrial techno, and there's some sort of, like, bullet dodgy slow motion stuff going on here and there. Like, you can see like a kernel of everything that was cool about that first Matrix movie in this, except for they put so much effort into making all that stuff look cool in The Matrix, and, you know, did, like, a very passable, you know, like, workman-like job of it in this, where nothing about it is, like, you know, it's all a lot of quick cuts. Like, there's no vision to any of the action in this, and it, like, lots of cool ideas that don't look cool in practice. Like, Blade has lots of throwing weapons, lots of glaive sort of things, where he'll throw a thing and he'll zoom around a room and cut a bunch of throats or whatever, but because of the way it's shot, you don't really see any of this happen. It's all just suggested that it happens, and not suggested that it happens in a artful way either. I don't know. It's all just kind of disappointing. Something that we keep sort of glossing over is the parallel plot line of the vampire politics, where Skeet Dorf is trying to...
I want to call him Vape Rig.
But, I mean, he's totally a vampire who would be using a vape rig now, but...
If we're going to refer to the actors by their names, and you're going to call him Skeet Dorf, I'm going to call him Vape Rig.
Fair enough.
Anyway, Vape Rig and his pals don't care at all.
They're trying to, like, usurp the vampire political order, and, like, apparently all the other vampires who were, like, leaders of their vampire clans were born vampires, which is a weird element of this vampire lore, that vampires can both fuck and reproduce. Like, I, you know, you think of Blade as, like, oh, he's this weird thing that just happened, but it seems like that phenomena would be reproducible if all of this was just like, bite some more pregnant ladies or whatever.
I hadn't thought of that as being a way that they would be pure blood.
It seems to be the implication. Like, it's not like they're
were bitten as well.
Or not even that, just their pregnant mothers were vampires. Like, I'm not, it's unclear how this all works, but it's very dumb. It's something that kind of bothers me about not only this, but, like, Twilight. It's kind of, it shows up in some vampire fiction. I mean, like, a lot of vampire fiction, really, where it's, like, the older a vampire gets, the more liabilities they have. Like, they, you know, accrue weaknesses, or even, like, in Twilight, they flat out just get weaker as they get older, so a young vampire is the strongest vampire. And that's something they sort of get into here, where it's, like, oh, vampire purebloods are, like, the real vampires. But every vampire gets their ass kicked by Blade, who's only half vampire, and every other vampire gets usurped or their ass kicked by Deacon, who is, you know, a person who was human and turned vampire. So it's like, I mean, I know in the real world, eugenics does not work out logically, that it's, you know, a false belief, but it's always, like, it always seems weird to have this very obvious order where it's like a young vampire is the most powerful. So how do any old vampires ever exist if they can be so easily dispatched by every new vampire they create?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer in this case is weird vampire rituals. Deacon's AutoCAD experiment, he's gonna, as revealed in the Book of Erebus, he's gonna resurrect some sort of vampire blood god, Lamagra. And at some point, Blade goes to, I think it's Chinatown, to get some ingredients to make, or to pick up his serum from...
His vampire suppression serum.
His friend in Chinatown who makes
thirst
it for him.
Thirst suppression serum.
So he doesn't want to drink human blood, which also seems unclear. Like, so he doesn't have the thirst, but does he see food? Vampires seem to get all their strength as well from drinking blood, and later in the film he regains his strength by drinking blood, so is he just like, oh, I don't have the thirst, and I eat like a human now as well?
I don't know.
Anyway.
They did not explain
they,
that.
They don't really make any of the... it's the weird thing where it's like, oh, here's all these scientific explanations for, you know, what vampire blood is like and how vampirism is a virus, et cetera, et cetera. But also, none of it really makes sense because it's still vampires. So when he's in Chinatown, he comes out of the shop, there's Deacon gripping a little kid by the throat. And he's like, I'm gonna fucking, his fingernail grows all long and sharp, and he's like, I'm gonna cut this kid's throat if you try anything. And Blade's like, sorry, I'm gonna try something anyway. And he pulls his gun on him and tries to shoot him. And Deacon dodges the bullets and throws the kid at a hot dog cart. Like, throws the kid so hard.
Through a hot dog cart.
That kid would be so fucking dead already. Or at least, like, some broken, like, that is just the, I mean... You always hear, like, oh, kids are so, you know, kids surviving car crashes and stuff. They bounce right back. They're more flexible than us crotchety old adults. But that kid would be fucking dead. And the kid lands in the street.
In front of a bus.
So at this point, it's like, man, Blade just does not give a shit about anyone.
No. He is a very destructive individual.
All he cares about is breaking everyone else's possessions and killing vampires. With alternating conviction in both, where, like... Sometimes it seems like he could go harder. Sometimes it seems like he could kill a vampire when he doesn't. So while he's saving the kid, Deacon beats it. It's now been established that he can pretty much just, like, hang out outside as long as he's wearing enough sunblock. Earlier they... I can't believe we skipped it. In his preparation for this ritual, is going to resurrect the vampire god. He decides it's time to kill the leader of the Vampire Senate, or whatever the hell they are.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know his name, but he's played by Udo Kier. And they take him out to the beach to meet the sun on a good old-fashioned vampire murder by making this guy who was born a vampire witness his first sunrise and ostensibly burn up in it. And they're all able to survive because they're wearing, you know, heavy clothes and sunscreen and motorcycle helmets with, like, UV visors. And at that extent, I'm like, okay, I can get on board with this.
It wasn't too far into the realm of unrealistic for vampires.
But what then it does establish is when Udo Kier witnesses this sunrise, he starts to burn up, and then he starts to sort of melt and swell, and then he's like a skeleton, and then he fucking explodes. And I thought, if I had a band, it would be named Udo Kier's Exploding Skeleton. So then back at this scene with the kid in Chinatown, Deacon Frost is just, like, dressed like a normal dude. And he's, I guess, just got sunscreen on his face and hands. And not his eyeballs or his lips or his scalp. But he still got under control. He's not...
The thing that bothered me through that whole scene... is that he has no protection on his eyeballs. He's standing in, like, dappled sunlight.
He could be wearing sunglasses.
He could easily be wearing sunglasses.
He could
be doing
have
something.
Had this meeting
he has no hat.
At night. Like,
yeah. There's nothing that indicates that he's like, you're a daywalker, Blade. And Blade is like, I am. And nobody's like, you also are walking in the day.
Right. Because, I mean, you think ultimately his whole plan is like, oh, we're resurrecting this vampire god to retake Earth from the humans and retake maybe daytime or something.
Yeah.
Like, it's unclear exactly what the vampire god is supposed
to
do.
Unclear.
And something you noted while we were watching is, like, what are they going to do without humans? and apparently this was a plot point that was filmed but cut, is that they were going to keep a, like a...
farm?
Yeah, like a humans in plastic bags that they would harvest blood from. It's like,
would
again...
Would they keep them in like a matrix of humans?
Yes, again, very much, this is the Matrix, but bad and vampires. After Frost chucks the kid and gets away, for some reason blades away from his shampoo factory, and Whistler and Karen are there, and Karen's like, oh, I'm doing some experiments with this anticoagulant I smuggled out of the hospital when I was stealing all of this other medical equipment, and when you put it in vampire blood, it fucking explodes, because most things apparently make vampires explode. And I mean, I'm kind of on board with this. Most of the time, vampires, like even in this, you kill a vampire the normal way, they, you know, dissolve to dust. Same in Buffy. Like, in True Blood, I think they turn into goo piles. It's usually just kind of, like, deflating it, and, like, deflating at most, gross at worst. But the exploding, I can get on board with that. While they're doing this, Deacon and his goons show up again in the middle of the day, beat the hell out of Whistler.
Yeah, that one didn't even strike me in the time that it was, again, daytime when all of the goons showed up to do their thing in the shampoo factory.
They really are cavalier about going out in daylight. It's super weird, especially, you know, like you were saying, you know, Buffy, that, like, it happens. They take precautions and it seems uncomfortable and it's not something they can just do, but they do it. But in this, like, the whole thing is like, oh, Blade, he's the Daywalker.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like that should be a lot more special than they treat it. So they kick the hell out of Whistler and kidnap Karen, and Blade gets back and thinks Whistler's dead, but he's not. And Whistler's like, they're gonna resurrect this vampire god. You gotta go stop him. Give me your gun. I'm gonna kill myself so I don't turn into a vampire. Even though it's...
Which, again, like, here he is. He's, like, he's got this weird gimpy leg, and he is dying from all of his injuries, and wants to kill himself instead of becoming a vampire and healing as a result of it. But, like, because they don't establish any downside to being a vampire aside from discomfort with drinking human blood...
Well, Whistler's, like, vague backstory is that he watched vampires kill his family.
Yeah.
Which I'm not at all certain on how any of that works out, because, like, you were there if you watched it. You didn't stop them. They didn't kill you.
Vague
they didn't
is
bite
the right
you.
Word for that backstory.
It's you know, the laziest of fridgings, and and also it doesn't, like, it's not like you see bite, like, he looks all beat up and torn up and stuff, but you don't see bite marks on him. Like, they could have shown...
I think his neck looked bitten.
His neck looked like, shredded, but it didn't look bitten.
Like, Blade takes, like, this cotton round.
Yeah, he's, like,
the
very...
weirdest little thing, and he's, like, dabbing at his face in this super passive, ineffective way, where I was like, what is he trying to achieve?
Well,
is
it's
he,
like, I mean, they want to show, like, this tenderness of Blade caring for his father figure, but also they don't want Wesley Snipes wiping off the makeup, because it's not like they put on prosthetic scars or anything.
And they don't want
they just
Wesley
smeared
Snipes to have,
blood,
like,
fake blood all over
him.
Well, I mean, he's Blade. He wouldn't show an emotion unless he was like
getting seduced by
well,
his mom.
No, no,
no.
Yes, but
no emotion for that either.
My favorite bits are when, like, there are some shots where Wesley Snipes will be, like, smiling in the background, like. Like, there's so many little moments where it's like, oh, this could have been played for a laugh or something, or, like, he was expecting it to play for a laugh or something. Because that's something else about this movie, was it tested super poorly with test audiences and was heavily recut, including the ending, which we'll get to eventually. But I wonder how much funnier it was, because there's only one line in this movie I really like, and it's toward the end. Like, It's the only line I remembered from this movie going into it. And it doesn't make any sense, but it's a primo line. I can't imagine David S. Goyer came up with it. We'll get to it. Because we're not there. I mean, it's still a ways
Hurry
off.
Hurry up. Get there. Anyway. So what's happening now? Whistler's bleeding out while
Blade goes to
dabbing at him with a tissue and not emoting.
Yeah, he's gonna go get his revenge and save his girlfriend. So he goes to whatever fucking building in obviously LA and gets beat up and tased by the vampires because they're ready for him. This was a trap, obviously, and both he and Karen are taken in a truck to somewhere. They emerge in this weird, like, marble mausoleum.
It's like the inside of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, but underground.
With, and like, vampire runes.
Symbiology.
Vampire glyphs all over the place.
Glyphs. Many glyphs.
And they take Blade and they take him, like, to this weird, like, magnetic tomb. And then his mom's and like, oh, guess what?
Oh, yeah.
I'm alive, and I'm super horny for my son, because I'm a vampire now.
It was so unsettling. I did not like that.
And he's like, oh, I love you, Mom, but I'm not horny for you.
No, that's too much emotion. He's more like...
I don't know. I felt him brooding under there, that he wanted to reconnect with his long-lost mother, who he believed to be dead, but also he didn't want to be horny for her. And so then...
What is that Oedipal moment doing in this movie? It was like such a... It really hit the brakes for me. Like, who did it serve for there to be that gross moment?
I think it's meant to show that vampires love gross. To fuck.
Okay. So anyway, they put him in this Han Solo thing.
Like a magnetic carbonite box.
Yeah.
And it has, like, built-in wrist-cutting blades, and it starts, and they throw Karen, this is something else that kind of confused me, they throw Karen into this, like, pit, and they're like, oh, check it out, we have this pit where, like, all the weird vampires go that are, like, zombies because they didn't turn into good vampires, because that happens sometimes, and we know about this pit, even though supposedly Deacon's the only one who knew about this mausoleum. Also, that we put some vampires in there. And while she's down there, creepy co-worker, former boyfriend from the hospital is like, Karen, I've acquired a weird affectation now that I'm a vampire.
He did have a weird affectation.
And he tries to, like, he's, like, saying the same lines from earlier, like, you ever think twice about us or whatever? And she grabs a bone from the dirt and beats the hell out of him.
But does not stake him.
No, but also, who knows if bones work, you know. Silver, yes.
They work
wood,
on
maybe.
Blade's mom in a little while. Oh, spoiler. Sorry.
Does she get killed with a bone?
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Okay.
So she's totally shown propensity for killing vampires at this point, too. So
yeah,
it is,
she loves to kill.
It is a little
odd. But I guess
odd.
He's an ex-boyfriend.
Right.
You know, things were already weird between
she's
them
just
at
like,
work.
I just didn't want to see you ever again. Right. And so she uses the bone. She climbs back up the old person chute. And while Blade is getting drained by this weird tomb thing, and Deacon Frost is positioning all of the other, like, representatives from the various vampire clans on their representative glyphs around this circular room, and Blade's CG blood drains through a series of tubes down this, like, half sphere on the ceiling, and
to hit all of them on the forehead.
Yeah, it hits them all on the forehead, and then hits. This is where we get to the little history bit about the recuts, because it's some of the worst CG like ever. But it's really bad. Especially like CG blood is such a huge thing in movies these days, and sometimes it's passable, but a lot of times it's like, oh man, that looks so weirdly disconnected from everything that's happening. And I mean this, it's late 90s, and just really, really awful fluid dynamics. Just the worst CG blood ever. So this glob of CG blood drips off the final one drips off the sphere and hits Deacon Frost in the face. And I guess that was... There's also some lightning striking
like,
shit,
and then
like
also
you know,
the
planets aligning. Oh, right, the skeleton.
All of the 12 people.
Oh, bonus eruptus.
Climb out of their mouths, and then different flying skeletons climb out of those mouths and go flying around while the original skeletons dust out.
Straight out of the Short Films of Springfield episode where Dr. Nick is about to get his medical license revoked when, like, a nurse barges in and is like, there's a crazed man out front. He's demanding to see our quack. And it's Grandpa Simpson's and he has a scalpel and is threatening everyone. He's like, I'm discombobulated. I've got ants in my pants. And Dr. Nick sits him down and he's like, what you're experiencing is bonus eruptus, a condition where the skeleton tries to leap out of the body through the mouth. And so he tears some wires out of a nearby lamp and starts electrocuting Abe Simpson with them. And that's the cure. And they're all pleased with the way he handled the situation and don't revoke his medical license. But that the skeleton leaping out of the mouth, something I never thought I would actually see done in something, but it's super weird.
But the flying skeletons,
because it is two skeletons,
are ghost skeletons also, and they fly in and out of Vape Rig while he's joining, like, all of the 12 are being electrocuted by lightning before that. But I think aside from getting blood dropped on his head and having ghost skeletons fly through him, Vape Rig doesn't have any electricity go on him.
No. Presumably the electricity is what scares this, just like with Grandpa Simpson.
Oh,
it's key to treating the bonus eruptus.
Okay.
So the bat-human skeletons swirl around and everyone else, like all the other vampires, are like, this is some weird shit, and they hide. Then Karen, after escaping from the people shoot, she gets Blade out of the out of his box, and he's like, oh, I had all my blood drained out, so I'm like totally useless now.
He's like, now my collector value has gone down.
Mm. yes.
Anyway.
She's like, all right, I guess drink my blood, and he does, and
and she's like, oh,
yeah,
drink my blood.
Seems like it's meant to be erotic, but it's also like, oh, he's
killing
is
her.
Is he gonna kill
is
her?
He killing her?
But then not really. Like that's the other, like that's usually something that happens in like every fucking vampire thing where it's
every
like there's always a situation where it's like, oh, I have to save the vampire I'm in love with by letting him drink my blood.
All of them.
Then of course he's gonna overdo it and almost kill
you're
me.
Overdoing it.
But in this, it's just like, oh, it seems like he's overdoing it. Then they're
cool.
She
seems fine. She gets up. She's like, I'm a little dizzy. And then the nurse gives her a cookie and a little bit of juice. And she's able to take on a full-strength vampire chick in a fight to the death, like, 5 minutes later. But Blade is so ramped up on her blood that he's able to go and fight literally everyone else there.
He's satiated and horned up. So he...
I don't know if I like hearing that.
He goes up to fight Frost, and...
Doesn't he kill his mom first?
I don't even remember him killing his mom, he stabs her with a bone. Now that's Oedipal.
Bone. Zing!
He keeps his eyeballs, though. He climbs up to fight Frost, and his sword's stuck in a wall, and Frost mistook his... we forgot the vampire exploding juice. Earlier,
Dr. Karen makes him a bunch of vials of vampire exploding stuff.
It's blue. She figures out this anticoagulant makes vampire blood explode.
It's called EDTA, not EDMA.
MDMA?
MDMA. It's EDTA. And so she gives him a little military grade... He makes a military
armband
of syringes.
Throwing dart syringe
and on
bandolier.
On his way in, he blows up a couple of vampires, but then when they capture him to throw him in the carbonite block, they throw it and it lodges in a crack in the wall
for us to come back to later. They mistake
inevitably
it for his serum, so they're like, oh,
you can't have
you
your
want
serum.
Your serum, buddy? We don't even realize this is a weird weapon that makes vampires explode.
But I think, you know, I missed my opportunity because of us skipping that whole part so far. Make vampires explode. When they take the old dude out to the sun, when he's on his way in and kills the couple of guards right at the elevator, and in the big moment in the movie, it is the exact same effect they use in Time Cop when two different versions of a person touch themselves. And Andy Garcia,
Not Andy Garcia. Ron Silver?
Ron Silver blobs out until he disappears. Only in this case, instead of the disappearing effect at the end of the blob out, there's an explosion.
Explosion of blood.
So, yeah, anyway. I don't know why I think it's important to point out that it's Time Cop explosion effect.
This is where a lot of the reshoots focused, was that originally Blade gets up there, and it seems like Deacon Frost is just the same dude, except for now his eyes are red.
Yeah, they're red.
And he's, like, kicking the shit out of Blade, but, he seems just, like, still a human, or a vampire, until Blade, like, cuts off his arm, immediately grows back, cuts him in half, a bunch of CG blood, like, tendrils, like, goop together and pull him back together. And so he's seemingly...
You just can't kill him!
Seemingly unkillable now. He does, like, he gets stabbed in the heart, doesn't do anything. So then...
I think it makes him laugh.
It does make him laugh. Presumably, very ticklish in the heart now. So then Blade notices his,
He's like a tickle monster.
His...
Blade... Like that guy on the new season of The Bachelorette. That's a Bachelorette joke for you.
Mm. Anyway. I mean, I read all of those, but I don't remember
Blood
that
God
one.
Tickle Monster.
Does go ahead. That go name ahead. The name does sound familiar.
Go ahead.
Then Blade notices his vampire exploding juice bandolier stuck in the crack in a wall. And he's like, oh, I gotta get that stuff down. It's probably the only thing that can kill this dude now. So he throws his sword up there, and it seems like, oh, Blade, you idiot. That was your blade.
Oh,
now
dear.
It's stuck in the wall.
It's
how are
in
you,
the wall.
How are you even gonna do anything? Then you see the little timer, because that's something else we forgot to mention, is that his cool sword has, like, a booby trap in the hilt that...
Works sporadically.
Yeah, a little timer that...
Only when it serves the plot.
That ticks down, and if you don't turn it off in time, then a bunch of little blades shoot out of the handle, and if you're Donald Logue, make your hand explode.
Yeah.
And no one else falls for it, but in this moment, the timer ticks down, the little blades fork out and knock the... vampire exploding juice loose from the wall, and Blade, you know, gets it and throws him like a shuriken at the blood god.
And then Vape Rig is like,
oh, this is gross. And then he throws a bunch more, and he's like, uh-oh, I don't feel so good. And then he starts swelling up all CG-like and explodes into a big glob of blood and is dead.
But this time, he does not regenerate because it serves the plot for him not to be able to come back.
Well, it's anticoagulant.
Oh, yeah, huh?
It checks out very scientifically, trust me.
Okay, well, you did the science.
I researched heavily. But, so, speaking of research, this was the part that was heavily reshot, as I've said, like, 50 times so far, where, originally, the blood god was literally blood, like...
Oh.
That CG blood effect that pulls him back together, the whole thing was just that CG, like a swirling mass of CG blood, like a blood tornado. It sounded stupid as hell. I didn't watch the scene, but it sounded like test audiences reacted really unfavorably. So they were like, uh-oh, everyone hates this awful CG blood monster.
Get Vaporing back in for a reshoot.
We need to get... Get Skeet Dorf back in here, teach him how to sword fight. Gonna have a really brief sword fight where they slash at each other really fast, and then, you know, go move on to this whole anticoagulant vampire exploding juice stuff to finish the day. Vampires are all dead. At some point, Karen fought with that vampire girl who has slick back hair, who looks very much like one of the characters from The Matrix. I'm forgetting all their names at this moment. But she's the one who says, not like this, when they're all getting unplugged and killed. Like, also had bleach blonde, slick back hair and a white outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Then they climb out of the mausoleum to the daylight, where they're in whatever fucking city. It's so obviously L.A., the thing. Like, I don't know if that's something they just didn't think people would notice or care about in the 90s. If, like, they figured... Like how modern times people think Vancouver can pass for anywhere in the world. Like if mm-hmm. in the 90s they thought L.A. was every city USA.
I don't know if I would have recognized the L.A. skyline then. But, I mean, it doesn't seem to matter to them at all where they are. So they climb out of the mausoleum, and then Karen is like, I can cure you of vampirism, but it will make you all the way human, and you won't have any of your cool powers anymore. And Blade's like, nah, sight. And then he's like, why don't you, now that my only other friend is dead, I give you permission to make me something to suppress my thirst for blood. Let's go continue to fight on. And then he goes to Moscow and fights a vampire in the snow, where he stands and poses for a really long time. And like, how long has he been there standing and posing in the snow before the vampire notices him? Because he's very posed. And then he's like, oh, I'm here to fight you.
It's an important part of the job.
The end.
That's sort of a weird, like, Whistler totally would have known that Karen developed, like, he was there, you know? He would have known that she developed a cure. If he got bit, cure would have worked on him. Because the cure only works on people who are made vampires rather than born vampires, so wouldn't work on Blade because he's too far gone, having been born half vampire. But it would work on Karen, and theoretically it would have worked on Whistler. And fucking spoiler for the second movie, Whistler's not dead, he comes back.
This movie, I'll give you my review now. It was dumb. Also, it fails the Bechdel test, which I guess is not that big a surprise, but, you know, is worth pointing out. The closest we get to two female characters being on screen at the same time, really. There's, like, two girls double-teaming Donna Logue at the bloodbath at the beginning. And then there's the scene where Karen and blonde vampire fight. And I do think they exchange a few words about something other than a boy. And technically that blonde vampire has a name, but we don't know it. It doesn't count. And that's about it. So, bummer on that. However, I can't dismiss it entirely because I am a big fan of diversity in casting. And having a black man and a black woman in the two lead roles, having a white dude be the helper guy instead of the main guy, and then setting so much of the exterior action in Chinatown so that even though they were all nameless extras, there were so many Asian people in the cast. You know, they were mostly walking on the street or doing random vampire kung fu or something, but, you know, they were at least on screen, which unfortunately is still something where you have to say, ah, oh, that is better than usual. So I appreciated all of that. And I don't think that you can dismiss, especially black male lead, black female lead, and not in a way where it wasn't weird about it, you know? It was very blasé about the fact that there was some diversity in the casting. They didn't make any kind of point of why Blade was black or, you know, why Karen was also black and a woman and a doctor. Like, there's some representation stuff that they got really right for that time and kind of, unfortunately, still right for this time. But I don't think that that is enough for me to say that I liked this movie. I thought it was really boring, and I kept almost falling asleep, and only stayed awake because I knew we were going to talk about it.
Oh, yeah. The one line I really liked is when...
Oh, that's the joke I wanted to...
Blade's about to... When he's starting his fight, his final confrontation with Deacon Frost.
Some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate uphill.
And...
What?
I mean, I sort of get what he's saying there. I'm not sure how it applies to the scene.
It does not. It is so random.
Maybe it's a super smart line and is in reference to the sunscreen in that, hey, Deacon Frost, you've already got this really affordable, easily accessible, simple solution to walking around at daytime. What do you need to do all this blood god nonsense for when you can't have that going for you? You're really trying to ice skate uphill here with this crazy plot. If you just settle for what you got, I wouldn't be killing you with anticoagulant vampire exploding juice right now.
Right. I didn't see this when it came out. I don't think I really started watching action movies until, I think, like, 2004. Aside from Terminator 2, I have no memory of seeing and liking an action movie until I had a roommate who loved the Lara Croft Tomb Raider movies. and played them so incessantly that I warmed up to them and then started really liking action movies. And so watching this now made me feel very sensitive to why I never felt tempted to watch an action movie at the time, because this felt so freaking lazy to me in terms of the story. And, you know, when you think about, I think you expressed it really well when you were talking about characterization and how they just didn't bother with it. Like, that's the thing about the current Marvel Cinematic Universe stuff, is that it's so accessible and the characters are so engaging and so likable, and you care about them and you know them, and it's not just getting to see them develop over all these movies. It's like,
yeah, because the stories aren't getting more complex.
Yeah, Guardians of the Galaxy is such a perfect example where, you know, even people who know the Marvel Universe didn't know that one. It's not a mainstream property. And so getting into it in that first movie, you had to like them without knowing anything about them. And you did. And, like, looking, like, how excited I am for Thor Ragnarok, it's not just because I want to see that Hemsworth take his shirt off all the time, although I do. It also is because it looks funny, it looks fun, it looks exciting, you know? It's going to be a good movie. You're going to feel like you spent your money well on that entertainment. And with something like Blade, or so many of the stuff, things that came out, you know, in the pre-modern Marvel Universe era, it's like they just didn't even bother with the script. They were like, explosion, explosion, fight, 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 car chase. You know, I really appreciate the diversity in the casting, as, you know, such as it is, flawed, but, you know, better than a lot. But it's a shame that that means that this falls into that category of Hollywood had a big hit with a minority-led cast. And the lesson that they took away from it was superhero movies can make money, not a black superhero can make money. Because, you know, when you think about who's really into Wesley Snipes and this character, that is something that would appeal to a lot of black women who want to see a superhero that they can get into in that way. And, you know, black boys who want to look up to a superhero that they can recognize themselves into some degree, like, that representation had value in that moment, but also it had a commercial value. And that's the thing that I get so mad about, especially when we're like, you know, this ongoing weak marketing for Wonder Woman compared to the other DC and big budget superhero movies, where it's like, you know, I want to spend money on this thing because it means something to me. Seeing Wonder Woman on screen, I want to buy my niece all of the stuff. Why are you making it so hard for me to buy a toy? Or, like, looking at Guardians of the Galaxy, why can't I find a Barbie-sized doll of Gamora and a Barbie-sized doll of Nebula that are available together in the same thing that I can give to my niece? Why is it so hard to find a kit of any of the recent Star Wars movies that are female-led where I can get the girls as, you know, a given? Why are there still so many kits of toys that exclude the female characters and stuff? And why 20 years ago did they make a movie that had two black leads and not take away from that? A movie with two black leads can be really profitable. That's a shame. Point number one. Point number two, this movie came out during season two of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And so it was, you know, on that upswing of the vampire craze. But that means that you can directly compare it to something that was on television that did vampire lore and vampire effects, vampire banter, everything better. And I feel like that's an objective thing and not just my opinion. Please don't argue with me, because I'm absolutely right.
I think you're correct, but also I think maybe overstating Buffy's prominence in that role. Like, Buffy is certainly a great example of it, but also the 90s were vampire as fuck in a certain sense, in that it's like, here's a bunch of Anne Rice novels and movie adaptations thereof. Here's this game, Vampire the Masquerade. Okay, like,
you're right.
Here's, you know, all these other shitty vampire movies, and like,
yes,
Buffy the movie and Buffy the TV show.
All of the things that were vampire that did not originate with Buffy, because Buffy is by far the best. But what, you know, the observation that I was about to make is that one of the elements of Buffy that's so critical to its appeal, as it turns out, that ensemble, the quippiness without losing sight of the heart and emotional intensity of the subject matter is Joss Whedon's trademark. And so when he brought that to the Avengers, it's like that's the point where I clicked in as a fan of all the Marvel movies, where suddenly they could be, they're not so self-serious. And that's the biggest flaw in the DC movies for me, is they're so freaking self-serious, and it's a flaw in this movie where everybody is taking themselves so seriously. There's no levity. And I really like the levity that Buffy had at the same time this came out, where you could, you know, you're still watching this life or death battle between humans and immortal creatures of the dark, but, you know, you don't feel, like, exhausted afterwards.
It's also, because another interesting thing about this movie was that it was rated R, and until Deadpool, I mean, I can't remember if Blade 2 was rated R. I'm pretty sure Blade 3 was not, but like you're saying, the takeaway from this is let's make more superhero movies, not let's give more minority characters and actors leads in superhero movies, is that not only did they make more PG-13 movies after this, like the next movie we're going to be doing is X-Men, which along with Spider-Man are considered, you know, where this whole boom really took off, even though it was ostensibly Blade that did it. But all of the movies after this are PG-13, and the Blade sequels, I don't think Karen returns. His sidekicks become Norman Reedus and Kris Kristofferson in Blade 2, and in Blade 3, his sidekicks are Jessica Biel and Ryan Reynolds. So it's like, not only do they not take the rated R approach to heart, they don't take the black leads to heart, they push against, like, it feels very much like, you know, what you would think of as typical studio meddling of seeing something succeed and trying to find some way to bend that success toward the status quo.
You know, talking about the diversity in casting, this is the same year that Rush Hour came out and was a huge hit.
Mm.
And, like, looking at what the top films were from this year in terms of box office, Eddie Murphy's Dr. Dolittle, Rush Hour, Mulan is up at the top, and I haven't gotten to Blade yet in terms of top box office for the year 1998. But this wasn't the only thing that Hollywood could have learned, minority casting in lead roles.
Like, I think The Matrix and X-Men probably served to scrub a lot of Blade's accomplishments from history, in that The Matrix was like an impossibly successful rated R movie, and also had all that, you know, nightclub, black leather, techno, gun violence aesthetic, and X-Men was a superhero movie that was PG-13 and made a ton of money. So anything that you could have held up Blade as like, look, do this, people would have been like, oh, you sure The Matrix wasn't the one that did that?
Number 29 for the year 1998. That was where it ranked in terms of box office earnings for the year.
What was it, like 200-something million?
It was 70 million.
Is that domestic, though?
Yes. Well, anyway, I'm grateful that we will get to see the progression of how they got better after this. And does that mean that we're going to watch both of the sequels?
I mean, you seem pretty distraught after this one.
And distraught?
Yeah, it seemed like you really didn't enjoy this.
Distraught's not the right word.
Mm.
Bored. Well, disappointed. But I didn't feel uninvested in the idea of seeing all of them. I mean, all of the movies that you had projected into our timeline, I just couldn't remember if you'd included all three of them.
Okay.
I'm in.
There are, like, I think 16 movies before we hit the Marvel Cinematic Universe proper, and I'd say a solid half, two-third of those are not good movies at all.
Yeah, but Here's the thing, though. I don't think that it would be fair to say that I only like good movies because I only like the movies I like.
Right.
If you look at the movies that I like the best, there it's all over the place. And, you know, like, there's... I have a lot of love for the Nicolas Cage genre. You know that I like an Adam Sandler movie.
Oh, no, no.
I mean, it's... I don't need it to be...
It's good that you like Nicolas Cage, because Ghost Rider is on that
really
list.
I really like Ghost Rider.
The first one?
Yeah.
It's a very dumb movie, but I enjoyed it more than
prefer,
the second one.
What's the one that I like better that he does? Not Ghost Rider. The one where he comes back from the dead.
I'm not sure to what you are referring.
Driving to
Hell?
Oh,
Drive Angry.
Drive Angry.
Right.
I love Drive Angry.
Yes.
Okay, well, I mean, the first movie in the modern Marvel Cinematic Universe that I really liked was the first Avengers movie. So, for me, even the first few solo movies from that, I didn't love them at the time. I thought they were self-serious.
Mm.
And the thing that turned me on to the Marvel movies was in the Avengers when they were all taking each other down a peg, and I liked them all so much better, and then I guess I'm not the only one, because they've been doing it ever since, and I always like it. It is silly that you turn into a giant green monster when you're angry. Let's acknowledge that. Or, hey, so you're a billionaire, and that's your superpower. Yes. Let's acknowledge that and have a little laugh about it, and then move on with our lives. Like,
I don't know. I'm curious to see how you feel revisiting those early Marvel Cinematic Universe
movies, I'm interested.
Because, I mean,
I'm down.
They have a decent amount. Like, I think
is Lara Croft one?
No.
Are National Treasure and National Treasure 2 Marvel Cinematic
also
Universe?
No.
I like those movies.
So I think this is where we wrap up. If you made it this far, join us next time. We'll be talking about X-Men.
I feel like it's going to pass the Bechdel test, which means something to me.
I'd kind of be surprised if it did, actually. I feel like most of that movie is just people talking to Wolverine.
But there's more than one girl with a name in it.
No, that much is true. But I feel like none of them talk to each other. I feel like they only ever talk to Wolverine and none of them ever talk to each other.
Why is it so hard for movies to pass such a simple test?
Because Hugh Jackman is a box office draw.
I guess that I shouldn't be as hung up on the Bechdel test. I should reintroduce the Nope friendship test that Kelsey Wallace and I introduced on our Feminists Watching Television show that we did briefly on YouTube, where in addition to the Bechdel test's rules that two women have to have a name and talk to each other about something other than a boy, Kelsey and I added the note, and they can't be adversaries. So that is the Nope friendship test, named for Leslie Nope from Parks and Rec. And that is the standard that I'd like to see Hollywood meet with every film all the time.
I regret to inform you that I can't think of a single superhero movie that will pass said test.
Well, let's hope that you're just overlooking something.
Let's. Until then.
Some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate uphill.